Prices shift, petrol jumps, shares fall. A company cuts jobs and suddenly the business story is everyone's story.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. From Monday to Thursday on ABC Business Daily, we break down the biggest stories in business, finance and the economy and why they matter.
Then on Fridays, I'll go deeper on That's Business, the people making decisions, taking risks and shaping where the economy goes next.
Find it all in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Gadigal Country, I'm Brooke Young, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Prime Minister lands in Fiji to ink a new landmark deal, the first stop on a whirlwind diplomacy blitz of the Pacific.
It is true that today the Pacific is a place of greater geostrategic contest than it has been before.
Defence Minister and Acting Prime Minister Richard Marles joins the program. Moving to the US and a blustery speech from President Donald Trump on a storm-hit 250th birthday celebration for the United States.
For 2.5 centuries, our American Republic has stood as the crowning achievement of human history.
You'll hear more of that speech and about some of the disruptions to this year's celebrations. Meanwhile, in Iran, tens of thousands of mourners have gathered in Tehran for the funeral of former Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Everyone in Iran is nervous about the possibility of Israel trying to pull off an attack during these funeral ceremonies.
All that coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. It's going to be one frenetic week of diplomacy for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. He's landed in Fiji over the weekend and will today sign the Vivale Union with his Fijian counterpart, Sitveni Rabuka. Now, this comes just a week after the government finally landed the Nakamal Agreement with Vanuatu and will be followed by a visit to the Solomon Islands later this week. Radio National Breakfast's political correspondent Tom Crowley was, as always, right across the details of this specific push and what the federal government hopes to get out of it.
Ink on paper wherever they can get it, I think, really, and it's all about China in this region. Last week we had the Nakamal Pact signed with Vanuatu. It didn't have everything in it that Australia would like regarding assurances about Chinese involvement in infrastructure, but just to get the pen on paper was tricky enough and a win enough, I suppose, in the view of the government. This time it's the Vivale Union in Fiji with Sitiveni Rabuka, the Prime Minister. Economy and security both notionally going to be involved in this and maybe a little bit more expansive, we think, than what was there with Vanuatu. Then it's off to the Solomon Islands. Matthew Wale, who seems to be much more enthusiastic than his predecessor about some sort of new security agreement with Australia, questions as well about what that country has signed with China. It is, as I say, all about China. The government is pleased with its progress in the region in that regard and wants to tell the world about it. The AFP's Chrissy Barrett is in New York to speak to the UN, talking about the role that Australia is playing training Pacific police forces and cooperating with them in the region. Again, the subtext of China's police involvement in that region, which Australia is trying to act as a counterweight to. It's all there. And then the Prime Minister's back home. He'll host leaders from PNG and Tonga for the State of Origin and then a stadium tour from the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, so a busy diplomatic week.
That's political correspondent Tom Crowley there. Now, Richard Marles is the acting Prime Minister and the Minister for Defence, and he joined Radio National Breakfast to break down the importance of this agreement with Fiji. And Sally began by asking him,
will it go further than last week's Nakamal agreement with Vanuatu in limiting Chinese involvement in security or infrastructure?
Well, it is a landmark agreement between ourselves and Fiji that is being progressed by the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. And it really will be a step change in the bilateral relationship that we've had with Fiji over a long period of time. And of course, that's a relationship which is already very close. There is a security dimension to this, and it will have Australia and Fiji working together for the collective security of the region, consistent with the Oceans of Peace Declaration that was made by Pacific Island Forum leaders last year's forum meeting. So there'll be more to say as the day progresses with the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister in Fiji. But this is a very, very significant agreement that is being progressed today.
Will there be stronger defence ties with Fiji in a similar way to the mutual defence treaty with PNG?
We have a very strong defence relationship with Fiji already. As I said, there is a security dimension to the Vivale Union, and we'll see us do more in the defence relationship. And I think that is really important. Fiji, of course, is one of a few countries within the Pacific which has a defence force, obviously New Zealand, but along with Tonga and Papua New Guinea. So Fiji is very significant in that sense. And the defence component of this is very important.
The Prime Minister will travel on to Solomon Islands. Does the government support the suggestion from Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Wale of a Pacific security bloc?
What we've already signalled when Prime Minister Wale was in Australia was that we are looking to progress a treaty in Solomon Islands as well. I mean, we want to build a peaceful Pacific. Obviously, the Oceans of Peace Declaration at the Pacific Island Forum last year was really important in relation to that. But I think the other point I would make, Sally, is if you just take a step back and look at what we've been doing over the course of the last 4 years, we've got the Treaty of Common Security with Indonesia. We've got the Puk Puk Alliance with Papua New Guinea. We are working on a treaty now with Solomons. We've signed a Nakamal agreement with Vanuatu, the Vivale Union, with Fiji, with France, which is a neighbour. Obviously, we have a status of forces agreement. And of course, we have the ANZUS treaty with New Zealand. What all of that represents is a ring of security now around Australia. And we have done more in terms of progressing the agreements in respect of that over the last 4 years than has ever happened before. And that is about ensuring Australia's national security, but it is very much about Australia playing its part with our neighbours in providing for a peaceful and stable region in which we all live.
Minister, last week the Prime Minister appeared on a podcast with comedian Nikki Osborne and had this exchange.
Jag, marry, date. Kylie Minogue, Nicole Kidman or Rhonda Birchmore?
I've just got married. I'm only 6 months in.
But if it goes tits up, let's just pretend.
Oh, Kylie, clearly.
You'd marry Kylie and Shagger and date her?
All of the above.
The Prime Minister's office has released a statement this morning saying that the Prime Minister, quote, apologises unequivocally for those comments. Did he need to make that apology in your view?
Well, look, the Prime Minister has apologised unequivocally, so that's the first point to make. I think from time to time we do interviews which are obviously different to the one that you and I are doing now. But I think the other point to make here, Sally, is that the government that the Prime Minister leads is the first government in nation's history which has had an equality in terms of the numbers of men and women in cabinet. It's the first government ever to have had a majority of women in the caucus. Under this government, the gender pay gap is the lowest that it has ever been on record. I mean, our Prime Minister is utterly committed to the place of women within our society and the elevation of women within our society. And I think that's the serious point to observe about the government that he leads. He's obviously made an unequivocal apology for what he said.
In that way, if you're talking about the government's record in your view in that regard, does that make these comments more out of place?
Well, look, the as I say, there are occasions where you do interviews which are of a different nature to the one that you and I are doing. In a serious sense, this government's record is there for all to see. And it's a government that is led by a person that I know very, very closely, who is utterly committed to elevating the place of women in our society. In respect of those comments, he has apologised unequivocally.
Richard Marles is the acting Prime Minister and Minister for Defence speaking there. And as you were hearing, Anthony Albanese is in the spotlight today for more than just this Pacific tour. He's also unequivocally apologised for comments he made on the Bush Deep podcast with comedian Nikki Osborne. So when Andrew Bragg, Shadow Minister for Environment and Shadow Minister for Housing and Homelessness, joined the program, Sally asked what he made of this incident.
I think these comments were beneath his office. I don't think he should have said them. It's good that he's apologised, but he shouldn't have said it in the first place.
How do you think it reflects on the PM?
I mean, I just think this guy's a shapeshifter. I mean, he'll do or say anything to get out of anything. You know, he'll say he won't raise taxes, then he will. He says he'll cut energy costs, then he won't. He's just a classic professional politician.
Let's move on to other matters. A draft decision by the UNESCO World Heritage Committee has seen the Great Barrier Reef avoid an in danger listing, but the UN body raised concerns over mass coral bleaching events. Is the federal government, in your view, doing enough to protect the reef?
Well, that's all good news, of course, but you know, we have to be cautious in running our environment policy and our conservation policy around international bodies. I think our own agencies are able to make judgments about what needs to be preserved and protected. And I'd say in the main, we have a lot of environment laws and we could do better on conservation, and we could also get the balance right when it comes to exploration and resource development.
Earlier this morning, I spoke to Lyndon Schneiders, the Executive Director of the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation, who said sediment flowing into the reef due to land clearing in the reef catchment area remains a problem, and there are doubts about whether the land clearing reductions required for the reef can be achieved by the Queensland government. Should the state government get on board further?
Well, that's a matter for the state government. I can tell you from a federal perspective, the very extensive environment protection laws are not always good for Australia, because what we've seen in the last year is we've seen effectively a prohibition on resource development, and you've seen the Prime Minister go cap in hand around to other countries begging for petrol. So we have to protect our best assets, but we also have to make sure that environment laws facilitate resource exploration. I think that's a top order priority. And I think Australians are very frustrated that we've become such a dependent bigger nation.
You're also a senator for New South Wales. At the Labor Party state conference in Sydney on the weekend, delegates voted unanimously for a new poker machine policy. It included freezing the issuing of new licences and significantly reducing the number of pokies in New South Wales. Are they sensible proposals in your view?
Look, I'm a bit tired of mandates. I think one of the things that people really hate about Australia now is that we have mandates for everything. And I'm not convinced that more rules are going to make Australia better. We have this thing called personal responsibility, and I'm not in favour of more rules and more regulations here in people's lives.
Do you see addiction as a health issue?
I do, and I understand it personally. And there are all forms of addiction. There's drug addiction, there's alcohol addiction, and these things are not easy to solve on a personal level and a public health level. But it doesn't mean that we should be taking away things from other people. I mean, one of the great lessons about COVID was it was insane to have locked up the whole population when what we should have been doing was just keeping the sick people isolated. People are rightly over mandates. I think this is one of the issues that we have now that Australians really are frustrated with our system.
What's the benefit of poker machines?
Well, it's a business. You're allowed to have a business. This is an enterprise economy. People are allowed to run businesses and make money. That's good.
For the community?
Well, I mean, people are allowed to gamble. I mean, it's part of Australian culture. I don't think it's government's role to legislate away leisure activities and commercial businesses. I think you'll end up being a pretty sick country if you legislate away businesses and you legislate away commercial opportunities and leisure opportunities for people.
Andrew Bragg, Shadow Minister for Environment and Shadow Minister for Housing and Homelessness. Let's turn now to Iran, where tens of thousands of mourners have gathered in the country's capital for the funeral of former Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader killed at the start of the US and Israeli war on Iran. Khamenei's coffin was unveiled late on Thursday before being laid in state in Tehran over the weekend. Now, three of Khamenei's sons attended the ceremony in the capital, but noticeably not his successor, whose whereabouts remain unknown. Giorgio Caffiero is chief executive and founder of Gulf State Analytics, and he said that this actually wasn't that surprising.
Yeah, well, I think it's very clear that there is a strong message that the Iranian leadership is sending out to the world, that despite the fact that the country came under attack from the United States and Israel, the dominant military power in the world and the most powerful military in the Middle East, Iran is still together as a nation. The Islamic Republic was not overthrown. This is a message of resistance and resilience And what the Iranians are really signaling to the region, and by extension the world at large, is that despite the fact that the country was under this intense attack and intense pressure, the succession process carried through. And this is really a message of continuity on the part of the Islamic Republic, despite the extreme circumstances that have been imposed on Iran since late February.
We're expecting very large crowds. How do you see the level of nationalism at the moment in Iran? And is that different from support for the regime?
Well, that's a really good question. Iran is a country of tens of millions of people. It's a very complicated, very dynamic country. The regime has its supporters. It also has its opponents. There are also many people in Iran who do not necessarily have a love for the Islamic Republic, but they certainly have rallied around the homeland, if you will. That is not necessarily to say they rallied around the government, but they certainly rallied around the homeland. I think it's important for analysts to avoid overgeneralizations. But what we do know is that the Islamic Republic certainly has a strong support base in the country. There are millions of Iranians who are out in the streets right now, and for many in the society, the killing of the previous supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, has been a very emotional experience, and he was a father to many in the country. I am certainly not saying that he was revered by everyone in Iran. Again, there are segments of the society that do not support the ruling government at all, but as I said, the government certainly has a strong support base, and I think we're seeing many of those Iranians out in the streets right now. It's a very, very emotional time for them.
Giorgio, we haven't had any public sightings of the new supreme leader since he succeeded his father. Is there any sense that that may happen in the next few days, or is there still uncertainty around his condition?
Well, there certainly are these uncertainties around Mojtaba Khamenei's condition. He was certainly injured during the attack that resulted in the death of his father and other family members of his. So that's obviously an important factor. But I think the Iranian authorities are also trying to make sure that the Israelis do not kill him as they killed his father in late February. Obviously, security is a central issue here. I think everyone in Iran is nervous about the possibility of Israel trying to pull off an attack during these funeral ceremonies. Also, even if Israel would not do that, they could certainly try to gather some intelligence to figure out where he would be going after the funeral. So I think definitely the authorities in Iran want to probably try to play things safe and avoid a scenario where Israel would be able to kill the current supreme leader of the country.
Giorgio Caffiero is chief executive and founder of Gulf State Analytics. Well, if you've been on social media at all over the weekend, you'll have undoubtedly come across some of the many celebrations of fireworks and flyovers being held in the US to mark 250 years since the Declaration of Independence. While there were celebrations all across the country, Washington, D.C. really was the centrepiece. But those celebrations got off to a bit of a rocky start after all attendees were told to evacuate due to severe weather warnings.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been asked to tell you, our officials have asked to tell you to we need evacuation right away.
Now, after this storm delay of nearly 2 hours, President Donald Trump appeared on the National Mall after 11 p.m. local time to give a very fiery address.
This country is the home of freedom. This is the land of liberty. And this is a flag of the most extraordinary, most exceptional, most incredible nation ever to exist on the face of the earth.
John Lyons is the America's editor for the ABC, and he dialed into the breakfast program from the country's capital to give us a bit of a rundown of what was actually said and not said in this speech.
I think this was one of President Trump's better speeches. It was far more traditional Republican pitching to middle America. When President Trump goes off script and free ranges, that's when his speeches can sometimes become unhinged. But because this was a big occasion, the 250th anniversary since that famous Declaration of Independence, it had obviously been worked on very, very carefully in terms of tone and who they were pitching to, which was, of course, not people like you and me, but it was the American public, the middle America. I think it was successful from that point of view. It was quite sort of Reagan-esque in that ability to talk up America, its history in terms of choreography. It was extraordinary the way it saluted the veterans of wars passed by the Americans, several veterans over 100 years of age, one 104, one 107. They all came on stage, some in wheelchairs. Their stories, of course, which Americans pay great respect to. They're held in very high regard, the veterans in America. So I think as a political speech, it was very well written, well delivered. It was quite different. This was a different Donald Trump. This was not a Donald Trump necessarily campaigning. This is a Donald Trump trying to look after his legacy. For me, the most interesting political hard edge to it was his use of the word communism. The Republicans are now going into these midterm elections in November wanting to very much try to portray the Democrats, at least the left of the Democrats, as communists. It's a very dirty word in America. And you can see now Donald Trump last night was essentially saying that, you know, the communists are on the rise, and they often lump in people like Zoran Mamdani in New York as into that category. So we can see the hard political edge that was in this speech.
We saw some nationalist protests surrounding this 250th commemoration. I saw online in one of the newspaper sites this morning a photograph on public transport of a young African-American woman surrounded by some of these nationalist protesters with their faces covered. What kind of presence did these individuals have?
Well, there's video and the photo to which you refer, obviously very disturbing images. That photograph by a Reuters photographer, I think, is an award-winning photograph. To have these 20, 30 men with their faces covered. Essentially, these are the modern-day Ku Klux Klan. That's why they don't want to be identified. Essentially, they're white supremacists who are too cowardly to be identified. 300 or 400 of them reportedly sort of marched through Washington, D.C. That picture is so powerful, to have that young African-American woman sitting in the middle of these guys covered up, these white supremacists. Really did evoke that Ku Klux Klan sort of history, which of course is a very dark history in this country.
John Lyons, ABC's America's editor. And that's it for this episode of The Breakfast Wrap. All interviews were done by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. This episode of The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Kathy Van Extel. I'm Brooke Young, and I'll be back with another edition of The Breakfast Wrap tomorrow morning.